I'm going to hand over now to Nick Gowing and Nicola Stern, who are going to share some memories and thoughts about Margaret Gowing. Nick Gowing and Nicola Stern.
Just call us Nick.
The two Nicks.
Yeah. Is there an old Nick or a...
I don't know who you're talking about. Hi, Nick. Good to see you. The clue for Nick Stern, Lord Stern of Isleworth, being here, of course, is not just because he's chairman of the Grantham Institute and also eminent at the LSE, but the fact that he's Lord Stern of Isleworth.
Brentford.
We lived in Chiswick. So in those days, there was Brentford and Chiswick.
Exactly.
So we were close neighbours, although we didn't know each other, and we went to the same school. But that means that your mother knew my mother, and we sort of knew each other. But what I'd like to do, if I can, Nick, is just before we get into that, these more personal reflections, I'd like to play one bit of video from what we were talking about. Stay where you are. No. One bit of video from answering that question from this morning about the US and the UK from Roy McLeod, because I couldn't put it in at that point. I'm actually going to live quite dangerously because I've changed a whole lot of stuff here over the next hour because of what's already come out from the discussion. So bear with me. I hope this is going to work. But this is Roy McLeod. For those of you who weren't here this morning, he's written the monograph. He's Emeritus Professor of Modern Science, History of Modern Science at Sydney University, formerly of Sussex and Cambridge and in London as well. And he wrote the monograph for the British Academy and the Royal Society. So much of what we're going to talk about coming up comes from there. But it's this particular answer which Matt referred to, and I think it's important to put it on the agenda now rather than a bit later. So bear with me if this is a bit rough and ready.
Roy, did you have any clarity about what my mother's attitude was to nuclear weapons? A personal view?
A personal view. I remember asking Lorna Arnold that, thinking that they must have discussed this in times past. As far as Lorna was concerned, Margaret felt that that the question had lost its meaning, in a sense, that nuclear, we are where we are, as the phrase goes. The existence of the bomb was something she felt that had to be accounted for. She was, at the same time, she was left-wing. She was against nuclear proliferation. She was very anxious that Britain's story and Britain's position in the nuclear enterprise should be well regarded, well understood. And that she realized, I think, and maybe well ahead of other people, how important the nuclear card was in the hand of British governments dealing with other governments. The nuclear club was an important part of history, and she saw the importance of Britain being in that nuclear club. If the price of that meant Britain participating in nuclear activities, well, then that's how it pans out.
But on balance, do you think she took a view of, I'm a historian, and that's what I have to record, as opposed to in any way skewing it because of a personal view of nuclear weapons?
Oh, I don't think she would. No, to my reading, she didn't skew in either direction or in any direction. She simply wanted to account for the things that they had come. But, of course, her own personal view, I think, would have been against nuclear proliferation.
What's emerged in your work about her attitude or her view of how the U.S. wrote its history?
Yes.
I know she had good relations with the historians there, but I'm unclear as to what her view might be of people like Dick Hewlett and what they were writing and any challenges they were facing in what was revealed.
Well, yes, there was some correspondence, not as much as thought that there might have been. They certainly knew each other. They were on cordial terms. They cross-referred on matters of fact. Their enterprises were quite different. The American business was extremely well funded. The Hilton Anderson were, what, three volumes, I think, altogether, were well underway. Margaret and Lorna heroically struggling. it's the usual asymmetry of that special relationship, if you like.
But did you feel she felt comfortable with the kind of way in which they were interpreting history?
No. Well, the first point is that that they were well ahead of her in articulating an American view of things. So she was, in a sense, catching up. And the reason, as I said earlier, or one of the underlying rationale for her Britain atomic energy was to put Britain's case there. All right. Now, the Americans, I guess, to be fair, weren't really aware of the British case. They had to be told this, broadly speaking, okay? They weren't averse to hearing about it at all, but it was not part of their primary task. So you can have official historians, friends and counterparts, if you like, not necessarily having to deal with the same issue in the same way, because their sources are quite different and they would tell different stories. Ideally, we would see them as complementary, but I don't think that Margaret ever thought that she would ever have the resources that she would have need in order to do something as monumental as the Americans. And so she was always a bit reluctant. She would tell her story, they would tell theirs, and the public would form its own opinion.
So, that the view there from Roy MacLeod. Nick, let's move on with some more personal reflections. We're going to move on to Oxford. We're going to move on to the University of Kent as well in the next 50 minutes and hear from a former student and also hopefully from my mother's successor and also from Richard Norton Taylor as well in the next 50 minutes. But Nick, welcome, and tell us your reflections on Margaret Gowing.
The personal side of Margaret directly, Nick, should come mostly from you. But my mother, Marion Swan, then Marion Stern on marriage, was born a month before Margaret and was part of that extraordinary group that was in Cambridge when LSE was evacuated to Cambridge at the beginning of the war. And they were really amazing people, and they were my parents' friends for life, and we knew them as a group from, and individually from, dinner parties, parties, family visits, and they were a group which just didn't stop talking about politics. As a child, that's virtually all we spoke about. and the effect stays with you forever. I think it's positive on the whole, but you know, Dad never took me to football. He was a German immigrant and thought that cricket and public schools were the work of the devil. But it was a very cheerful childhood, very intense in many ways, but that group was always there. And it was a remarkable, remarkable group. Mum had this extraordinary regard for Margaret. I think I met Margaret probably only two or three times and don't have a very strong memory, but I do have a strong memory of what my mother used to say about Margaret. And she always regarded her as wise as well as clever and had enormous respect for her ability to take on what they always used to, all of them, regard as the establishment, particularly the male establishment. I mean, when we were sorting through my mother's effects after she died some 20 years ago, we found one letter appointing her as a graduate from the London School of Economics to the highest level in the civil service available to a married woman. And it wasn't a very high level. I mean, in the 50s, I mean, we have to remind ourselves, women were expected to give up their job when they married. And it is an extraordinarily different time. So that respect, a mutual respect amongst the women of that group, was very powerful, and the bonds were very powerful. And Margaret was regarded as the great high achiever amongst the women of the group, and indeed the great high achiever amongst the men of the group as well. So I think we have to remember that time. Margaret, if I understand it, was born in the Portobello Road. My mother was born in the Walworth Road, you know, west side, east side, but similar kind of background. My mother's wasn't a working class background as such. It was an immigrant background. Her parents, my grandfather on mother's side was a doctor, and from living long-standing life in St. Petersburg, although there was a Brit up the family tree at some point, and my mother's mother, maternal grandmother, was a nurse, a Muslim nurse from Turkmenistan, and they met during the First World War in Ukraine, serving as a doctor and a nurse. So they came from an immigrant background in a very poor part of London, but a different kind of background. So that and my mother did a sociology degree under Harold Laski, and always regarded him as a source of infinite wisdom, and he was obviously a source of some wisdom. And she taught British Constitution at a local secondary modern school in Brentford, and later actually became a JP, so I suppose she became a member of the establishment. So that's I won't dwell too much on my mother, because this is about Margaret, but that respect for Margaret in that group of friends was really remarkable, really remarkable. And it wasn't bated breath. It was with sort of comradely admiration that they always spoke of her. Now, they lived the politics of the time. They were lifelong friends. But just to remind you who some of them were, and these, I'm only talking about the people I really got to know. Of course, there were more. Chris Freeman, whose work now is really coming to be very deeply respected. You know, he sort of emerged again as the very powerful historian of technological progress in the spirit of Schumpeter, and it's Chris who identified really the five waves of technological progress that we think of now. And some people talk about three, others, you know, I always found Chris's numbering, and I can go back over it if you want to know what that numbering was. But he was an extraordinary guy, and he founded SPRU in Sussex and has left a legacy that keeps on growing. There was Norman Mackenzie, who was very instrumental in founding the Open University. Insufficient credit, in my view. He was one of the moving spirits behind that, biographer H.G. Wells, and so on. And they had a very nice, short, recent, he died a couple of years ago, recent story about Napoleon in the UK. And it was, this is, you know, Klaus Moser. I mean, Klaus was quite an extraordinary figure in British history in the Second World War, and really setting up the National Statistical Office. I mean, that was Klaus' work, as well as being, head of the Royal Opera House, chaired a big fundraiser as a trustee for the British Museum. And Klaus was absolutely the centre of British life, like my father, a refugee from Hitler, and both of them interned during the Second World War. Mary Moser, Klaus's wife, was also there. She was part of that group, LSE Cambridge, when it came. LSE was evacuated to Cambridge. Steve Wheatcroft. Those are the people that we, in a sense, the party's now house for those people. And there were Cambridge friends as well, John and Freddie Vickers. And some of those friendships have gone through the generations. Sally Vickers, a novelist that many of you probably will have read, is the daughter of John and Freddie Vickers. That group was a really extraordinary group. They were, in a very rich and deep sense of the word, they were comrades for the rest of their life. Many of them were members of the Communist Party, not all. We think my mother was a member of the party for about a year, but we never found any record, and we're not really sure. And it doesn't matter very much either. That group was bound together in politics. They were great internationalists and great socialists. You know, the songs would be, you know, "I'm the man, the very fat man that waters the workers' beer," and my mother did a fabulous rendering of "My baby has gone down a plug hole." And the poor little thing was so skinny and thin, you know, ought to have been bathed in a jug.
Can't you do it, Nick?
And, I didn't inherit. My uncle was Donald Swan, my mother's brother, who of Flanders and Swan. So I think the musical side of the family disappeared off in that direction. But that's the my father would do. My father had couldn't sing either, but if he was going to sing, he used to sing the Internationale in German, which of course was his mother tongue. So you have to picture who that group were. They felt the delay in the great internationalists too, and of course supporters of the Soviet Union, particularly at wartime, and they would often refer to the big crime in their eyes of the very delayed Second Front, and they would associate that. I mean, Churchill was the man in our house who delayed the Second Front and broke strikes in the 1920s. That was our image of Churchill. It took me a long, long time to find out that there were people who admired Churchill. Such was the powerful influence at home. Nye Bevan, always against Ernie Bevin. Nye was the man, and my very first political memory is in Trafalgar Square at the time of Suez, hearing Nye Bevan shout, "Out, out, out." I won't try to do the Welsh accent, but the it was an extraordinary group, and of course the children of our parents' friends were often there amongst us. The spirit of Attlee was regarded as the peak of British politics. I think it's a very powerful argument for the truth of that statement, but in our house it was always the case that Attlee was never considered a big guy, but the government was considered in our house the real story, with Nye Bevan being the great hero. That group was traumatized by the invasion of Hungary in 1956, and those who hadn't already left in that group, with very few exceptions, who hadn't left the party, left then. But most of them had already left. And so I think my mother was a member only for a year or so during the war. And my father, like not enough of that group, saw straight through Bolshevik ideologists. You know, the idea of dictatorship of the proletariat revolted him, even though he was deeply left-wing and a really good socialist. So you can see that this group of socialists argued with each other loud and long into the night, because they really did disagree about so many things. But they didn't disagree about the basics of a decent society and of internationalism. I mean, John Vickers, for example, asked for the Marseillaise to be to be played at his memorial gathering, and it was indeed played at his memorial gathering. They were deeply, deeply internationalist. They were virtually, to a woman and man, members of CND, and so were we. That's how we were brought up. The first time that my dad had Germans into the house, I remember he lost his mother in the concentration camps, and my grandmother, was German people marching during the early 60s from Aldermaston to London. And they were all right as far as he was concerned, but he wouldn't speak to a German born before, say, 1932 or 33, because he couldn't be sure what they were doing. But that younger group, he actually picked out and sought out in large measure because they were German and associated with the cause. So I'd wanted to try to give you a feeling of who those people were. They were quite a remarkable group. I think, Nick, we're very privileged to be children of that generation of people. Deeply, deeply good. I don't think any of them ended up poor, actually. They ended up quite comfortable, I think. But that never drove them. I mean, what drove them was the idea of a good society and internationalism and comradeship.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. Tremendous. Do stay if you can. Richard Norton Taylor, can I bring you in at this point? But not because of the background, but simply because you have to leave shortly. And you handed me a note which my mother wrote to you on the 3rd of January 1985. And I'm going to flatter you now. I should say that I've been impressed, very impressed with your own reporting and writing on your great variety of subjects in the last months. But you wrote the obituary to my mother in The Guardian. What are the memories that you've got, your personal recollections? Because you had a lot of contact with her.
I'm sorry I missed that session.
Why don't you come and sit?
Come
here. Yeah, come.
Nick, could you just quickly introduce to not everybody knows?
Yes, indeed. Richard Norton Taylor, diplomatic editor, I think emeritus.
50 years I was a Guardian journalist writing on security and defence and so on. Anyway, and I'm sorry I can't hear down there. Can you hear?
It's all right.
Can
it's all right. Hear me? Mick is just telling you to speak up.
Very quickly. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Is that mic on?
I recognise some faces here. And it was a pity I missed the first session, or one of the sessions earlier on, what shall we tell Mrs. Gowing? I think she thought that she might have... I think she saw us. She saw me and another then member of the Fourth Estate, one Peter Hennessy, who right up, we went to as it then was, a public record office for a very long time, through the 70s and 80s, and she thought maybe we were going to be needed as potential allies, really, because she had this concern, I think, about, and maybe it came out this morning, did it, about what she'd be allowed to say, in quotes, and not in the official history, and she wanted to encourage us, I think. She was, you know, generally committed to getting out as much as possible, and she also knew, I think, I hope she knew, that she could trust one or two members of the Fourth Estate, certainly me and Peter. And she was also concerned, I think, as this letter says, actually the main part of this letter is really about her concern that when she had finished in 85, she said, my atomic history is lagging behind the 30-year openings. I do not know which of the documents I have taken notes from are open in the PRO and which are not. So she wanted a genuine sort of interest. We went there at the end of the year before, you know, on embargo and stuff, what was actually coming out and what she could tell us and what she could say had already been officially published. That's really all I wanted to say, that I think, you know, she was concerned about what I'd call the establishment or Whitehall keeping things, not only from her, but from us. One particular question, which I really interested me and her, I think, too, was what was then called joint decision, wasn't it? And she was encouraging us, anyway, to write about things which are sometimes provocative, but in, a responsible way. That's what I have to say.
How much did you feel she was skating on thin ice? Because that's some of what emerged this morning. I mean, yeah. Not that phrase wasn't used, but certainly this balance between getting it all out there, but also the feeling of pressure as well at times.
Well, it was then a very, even more, well, Trident is obviously a controversial issue, I've been recently, but then, I think during the 80s, it was cruise missiles, American, and it was, and all that stuff. And a question of joint decision, I think, American bases in the UK and so on. It was a big, controversial public issue, some promoted by me and even by Peter. She wanted, you know, a genuine, good debate out as much as possible, I think. Equally being concerned that she was, you know, an official historian and so on. She, I suppose, was most of the time off the record, but not always. And we were quite careful about what she could say on the record. We were, you know, as I say, quite a responsible. And she was, and I was very impressed by her, a very impressionable person, a bit younger than I am now. And she was it was a great mutual relationship, I thought, and probably a unique one. I don't know what Peter would say, between someone who was writing about this, you know, as an official historian, and with a couple of, well, certainly me as a journalist, The Guardian, and this very good professional interest, more than that, really, because, you know, empathy, although we didn't really talk about her left-wing views and other things we've been hearing about, I think it was implicit, but I didn't never talk to her about
about her background. It was more, as I talked to her, really, 100% as a journalist.
All right, Richard, thank you very much. What I want to do now is move on to the challenges of what happened after the great success and into the more difficult times when she decided she had to go to the University of Kent. Almost a time of personal torture, and the phrase came out this morning that essentially the volumes ground to a halt. The enormity of the challenge to write versus the real personal and practical pressures. And here is Roy MacLeod talking about that, which led to her decision to go to the University of Kent.
Well, it must have been a struggle. I know myself. I think anyone who writes a book, anyone who has a family and writes books, knows some of the demands that are made on the on the family support structure. She, of course, was very anxious to establish herself as an academic, and after the end of the official history, she had to do this.
When she went to the University of Kent.
Kent, and this was an important step for her. It was intended, I don't know, you will say whether it succeeded, to establish a baseline, a salary for her. This was a tenured appointment, and it was to give her the wherewithal to keep you and your brother, in the absence of your father, in breakfasts for a long, long time.
And there's someone else called Vera, who looked after us for 17 years, who my mother had to pay. It's this balance of trying to be a distinguished historian, working in a university, but looking after a family at the same time.
Exactly. Well, my impression is that she came to the decision that the more flexible life then available to academics was more conducive to doing that, to doing just that, that she could write her books and look after her family and deal with an academic career in a more flexible way than she could have had she returned to the civil service.
But for you as a historian, you write, I think quite accurately, that it was an uncomfortable time at the University of Kent.
Yes, she didn't get on with the then Vice Chancellor at the University of Kent. I've tried hard to see what the agendas were there, but I think the Vice Chancellor expected her to do things that she really didn't want or have time to do. He wanted her to do much more teaching than she thought would work out with this new balance strategy that she had in mind, and that didn't go down well. And also, I think that she found it a little inconvenient, actually, to get in when to committee meetings and such, at a time that she had to juggle schools and carers. So it was an experiment. I look back upon that in her life.
It seems to me that she was probably trying to square a circle. It was all too much.
I think it must have been very hard. And of course, this didn't endear her to people in Kent. And so she was looking for another opening wherever one might come.
I think James and I can remember that as a time of difficulty and almost a sort of personal torture. But let's now move on quickly to after the University of Kent, where it didn't work out. I happened to be down there last week. It was interesting remembering what it was like. It brought back memories, how difficult it was for her and the kind of things we would hear, even though she was writing at the same time, and I occasionally found all these documents on the breakfast table when I came back from my paper round, which were classified documents and she shouldn't have had there for those who weren't here this morning. So she was trying to juggle a number of things, including getting on very early morning trains, going up to Aldermaston and Harwell to work with Lorna, and then getting on the train and coming back, as well as trying to fulfil a curriculum at the university, which didn't work well because of her relationship, particularly with the Vice-Chancellor and Head of Department. So how did she end up in Oxford? This is 8 minutes of Roy MacLeod explaining what happened and where she found a degree of respite and relief from the challenges of Oxford.
Margaret saw the advert of this chair, the first such chair in the history of science at Oxford ever. She saw it and showed the advert to Lorna. Lorna said, "You must apply." And Margaret who didn't leap at that suggestion. And it wasn't apparently until the day of the applications, the day of the deadline for applications, that Margaret's application actually went in. She wasn't at all optimistic of the outcome, I think, but she soon found herself, her application becoming an interesting pawn in that game of chess that faculty committees sometimes play, because A, she was a woman, and there were very few women professors at Oxford at the time. B, she was working in an area in which there was a lot of interest in Oxford, because the nuclear knights, so to speak, tended to focus on Oxford, and of course surrounded, as Oxford still is, with the Harwells and the Cullens and the Rutherford Laboratories and the rest. And this was the nuclear epicenter, if you like, of Britain. And Margaret was a contemporary historian. This might have said something for contemporary history and against the interests of the medievalists and even the early modernists, who hadn't managed to do much by way of research at Oxford, according to the likes of many people in the history faculty, but who were very knowledgeable people, but they were not part of the future, so to speak. The future was to be, in the future of the subject, the future of Oxford perhaps, was to be seen in more exciting, multicolored lights.
How do you believe she got the post there?
Well, I try to be as accurate as faculty records will permit in recounting the circumstances of her election. The committee included a number of people who were friends and sponsors of her principal rival, a man who had been at Oxford for quite some time and who had held a number of important conferences and who was seen as in some sense the logical, if not the rightful, inheritor of that position. On the other hand, Margaret had a couple of people on the committee who were against that interest. Some personal assertions were involved. I won't go into those now, but they're in the book, they're in the manuscript, and people can examine these more closely and form their own judgments. But there was a clear split in the committee, and Margaret won. She was aided and abetted, I think, by the fact that the chairman of the committee was on her side, the then vice-chancellor of Oxford. It's helpful to have that sort of friend, I think, at that particular point in events. And she was, I think, welcomed by him, and indeed by the scientific faculty.
How would you describe her tenure at that post at Oxford?
Well, it was for the first time, as it were. A, she was a woman. B, she was a professor. C, she had no Oxford experience.
Would you say it was a comfortable experience?
No, I think it wasn't, and it seems to have been clear from the very outset that it was not likely to be a comfortable experience. I think many people at Oxford, even today, find it a little disconcerting to be welcomed as a professor. Good day, professor. I'm glad you're with us. I hope you have a wonderful time. Go and write your book and come and see me if I can help. That is to say, there is no department to speak of. There is no secretarial help. And in Margaret's case, there was no office. She had nowhere to work. She had no one really to help her find a place to live. I don't know where you were at school at that particular point.
I was at school. University.
You were by that point at university. But she had very little infrastructural help in getting settled. And, of course, she also had the difficulty of the difficulties of dealing with the Oxford faculty structure. She was appointed, her chair was vested, was lodged in a research, in a graduate college, Benefer College. But the way in which to advance a subject at Oxford is usually through undergraduate teaching and through the schools.
Unless you are in a college, unless your chair is in a college where, which has undergraduate students, you're very much in the hands of the tutors of the other colleges to recommend students to come and take your courses.
How much do you think that affected her ability to deliver on trying to write the next history? Because I remember her going up to London a lot.
Okay.
But you could feel she was being tortured by something.
Well, the fact is that professors at Oxford at that time were not required to do much formal teaching. But the formal teaching she had to do was in subjects in the history of science about which she knew very little. Because she couldn't generate, through her college connections, an argument for another lecturer, she had to do everything herself. This compounded with the fact that she had kept on her commitment with the Atomic Energy Authority, meant that she was always torn, I think, in at least two directions, and had to apportion her life and times extremely carefully. As I say, it meant perhaps her having to be away in London a lot meant that she couldn't spend as much time in the convivium, as it were, of Oxford, which is very, very important if you want to get things done, if you want to build a department, for example, or if you want to get resources for another appointment. Her friends, also to complicate matters, were in the science faculty, not in history. She had very few allies. I can think of only one in history. Most of her friends were the nuclear knights. They were in physics. But when it came down to the business of running an activity, you needed allies where they were counted. She didn't have them. So she found herself increasingly called upon, as it were, to deal with Oxford in some ways, and to create the time and space, the mental space, to do what she had to do. This, I think, again, increased her dependence upon Lorna. It could only have done that. And it made it ever more difficult for her to meet her timetable, I think, her own personal timetable. She was also, though, I really must add this, very generous with her time in dealing with other people, in dealing with students. Many, she had perhaps fewer than 10, but about that order, between 5 and 10 graduate students who did their theses with her. And all speak very warmly of her and of the generosity she showed in time, and I think in other ways too. And this, I think, all of which is bound to absorb energy and bound to take her away from that huge task, 50 miles away, and dealing with Oxford, dealing with atomic energy.
And joining us now is one of those graduate students, Jeff McAllister, who lives in Britain, lives in Maidenhead now, has been living in West London for a long time with his wife Anne, both of them now leading lawyers. Jeff used to be Time Bureau Chief here in London, so we've known each other a long time. But you're here to talk about Margaret Gowing and what she meant to you.
Thank you, Nick. I feel bad that I kept her away from the work that she should be doing, having seen this clip. I met her in 1978. I just graduated in history from Yale, and I hoped to go to Oxford, and was quite fascinated by deindustrialization, which then seemed to be happening in the United States, the decline of the traditional industries, etc. Michael Howard once told me that Oxford considered all topics after 1871 to be journalism. But I was interested from my previous work and my own predilections in 20th century history, and it seemed to me that the story of the incredible flowering of British science and technology during the war in all the areas that we know, in atomic energy, Spitfires, radar, antibiotics, code breaking, many others, followed by the kind of fizzle of British science and technological advance in civilian terms after the war, presented an obvious kind of topic. I had read some of Margaret's work and made an appointment to come see her, and she invited me very kindly and said, quickly, all those papers that you would be interested in are going to be declassified under the 30-year rule in the time that you might be here, so I'd be delighted to supervise you. And also, this is where you should live in Oxford, and also I might suggest Lineker College, which she was a member of. She was very nice about it, and I did join Lineker College, a graduate-only college, which was relatively new at the time, and a wonderful place. Her recommendation was based on the fact that it combined people from many disciplines, and had reliably good food, and was an unstuffy place of academic fellowship, and I, too, found it to be that way. She, as a thesis supervisor, I thought was perfect in the role. She was demanding, acute in her judgments, tolerant of byways for which I had enthusiasm, some of which amounted to something. She didn't hover, but when we had supervision sessions, I came out feeling like I had been well exercised. My intellectual muscles ached a little, sometimes bruised too, and rightly so. I really admired her and liked her for the following reasons. Number one, the life history that we've talked about. The first woman professor of history at Oxford, as far as I understood. I'm not sure that's true. The daughter in this improbable poor family in London, just scraping by, giving, as I understood, half of her LSE grant money to her parents so that they could eat. I remember her telling the story of being on a commission or committee of distinguished people. I think during the winter of discontent, the details are a little lost to me, but it was a committee of the great and the good to study some important problem. And she was told by a conservative lord on the committee that he just wished people would pull together and look after each other like they had in the past. And she said, I got furious and said no one had been looking after my father when he had tuberculosis and her mother couldn't get a teaching job and we were poor. And she said the Lord actually did apologize and they became friends and all worked out. She talked about the marriage bar in the civil service for her and her struggles to be taken seriously as a civil servant. And I think she understood injustice and viewed her own ascent as something that she both deserved on the merits, which she clearly had, and also as partly due to good luck, which she hoped others would also have. She was proud of her accomplishments, but never, ever a snob about them. Second, I really admired her determination, a determination to use all the gifts she had and worked so hard to develop to their utmost. Despite the burdens, she found her way, producing these lucid and fantastically crafted books at her kitchen table from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. after putting the children to bed, as I understand it. Nick, maybe you helped with the footnotes. and always remembering to thank Vera, the childminder just referred to, in her acknowledgments as a vital part of what made it possible. She did say that she learned about atomic energy the first time by going and buying a children's book about atoms and starting from there. But as I was saying before, she didn't think that this knowledge should be so remote that someone of her intelligence shouldn't be able to figure out enough to be able to write a book like this from. And when she was concentrating on an argument or work, you just felt the glow. To be edited by her was a bracing experience, but wonderful. All my sweeping language and overwrought conclusions down the drain. She didn't make you say what she wanted to say, but what you wanted to say, just clearer and better. She read my chapters closely and found all their weak points. She put the effort in line editing multiple chapters, and I loved the energy and clarity of her prose and have modeled mine after hers, I think, to great effect. I admired her range of interests, folding leaflets for the Labour Party in Oxford, founding and shepherding the Contemporary Scientific Archive Center, which I think was a vital contribution, and I saw a lot of the work that she put into that when I was at Oxford. Serving on the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Council on Public Records, based on her unparalleled knowledge and experience of government archives and how best to use them. I had spent a lot of time at the PRO, of course, in Kew, and had my own ideas about what they were doing well at the ground level, with which she tended to agree, so I took a real fan's interest as she reported the work on this advisory committee. But if there was ever a more political, backstabbing, vicious committee than this one, outside of Beria's Politburo, I don't know what it was. When many of her proposals were rejected by the civil service, and I remember particularly the oleaginous and condescending letter written by a junior saying of course they valued her work and had adopted most of her ideas, except, of course, for all of them, and certainly all the important ones. I remember her real fury, her conviction born of long experience of the civil service and academic politics that she was not going to be neutralized by this young pup without a good fight. And she waged it using her network of contacts, her skill at argument, and at puncturing Kant to wrestle the outcome back her way. I don't think it was a complete victory, but there was progress. She was a great tactician, as I saw as she figured out who should read my own thesis, or maneuvered through various landmines deposited by those who remained jealous of her at Oxford. She had a sense of the human comedy and did enjoy the fight most of the time. Finally, I remember her warmth and her kindness. My own daughter just submitted her DPhil in history at Oxford 2 weeks ago. And nowadays, things are a lot more organized. More seminars, reading each other's papers, busy schedule of sessions from visiting historians. Most of this was absent in my day, I must say. But she did her best to provide that sense of community with regular seminars at home when the history of science students, ranging from experts in Chinese science and the origins of the scientific method in the Enlightenment philosophy and 20th century historians of technology, all would have a glass of wine and cheese puffs from Marks and Spencer at her house and get to know each other and our work. She cared about us as individuals, and you felt it. My wife and I had a place in London for a few months when she was doing research there and stayed with us from time to time. She was just fun to have around. She loved to have a meal made for her. She was very fond of my macaroni and cheese recipe, made with a lot more cheese than she was used to. She was glad to peel carrots and interested in politics and my family and everything. She will talk about her family, and I remember her pride in Nick, whom I did not know at that stage, then gallivanting around the world, I think for ITN, mostly in Poland at that stage. And she told this story on him, which I have to tell on you, Nick, where he came to visit for Christmas, and he brought her flowers. And then he got a phone call from his editor that some natural disaster or something had happened nearby, and he had to go do the story, and there was a kind of bereaved family that he had to go see on Boxing Day. And he asked his mother for the flowers back, so...
I got to tell you, I was told that Jesus had been born in Swindon Hospital.
Well, then it was in a good cause.
Yeah, exactly.
He did, I think, replace the flowers in due course.
We've got them here.
And she was very proud of him and of his work and took real pleasure. And it has been a great pleasure for me to get to know Nick in the now 16 years I've been back in Britain and working as a journalist, and our paths have crossed. And I would say he's a chip off the old block in ways that I find sometimes eerie and always lovely. I didn't finish my DPhil when I was in residence. I came back several years later to submit. Thank God I did, because the most important thing was not to let Margaret down. That was 1987, and I could sense, even in our brief interactions in this week I was back in Oxford, that she was struggling. Maybe it was all the burdens we've talked about. Maybe it was the onset, to some degree, of Alzheimer's. She was so trying so hard to get the next volume done, going away for research, coming back home in the evening, and she told me that she just found it hard to cook in the evening and went to leave some cold things in the fridge. And I felt bad for her. So as a departure gift, I brought her something that was novel at the time and also seemed right somehow, given the time I had spent studying the cavity magnetron and its role in boosting British-American scientific cooperation early during the war. And this was a microwave oven. So I carried the box up the stairs to her flat, installed it in her kitchen, and she was gratified by the outsized gesture, but said with quite evident alarm, "Will it ruin my good china?" She treated this thing as if it were a nuclear reactor. So I did a few trial runs and even had brought in some Marks and Spencer fancy ready-to-cook meals to show her how it might work for her. But actually, if it ever played any role in easing her burdens, I would be surprised. So many people do have bad DPhil supervisors. In my current line of work, where we represent victims of child sexual abuse and sexual harassment and employment discrimination in the law firm that my wife and I run, we see bad PhD supervisors in this country and in others. I had a wonderful supervisor, engagement with a wonderful mind and a wonderful person on multiple levels, an exemplar and a friend. One of the truly important relationships of my life. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And I know from the way Jeff described it, even when he didn't really know that I was connected to Margaret Gowing, that that was important to you. So thank you. And I know Anne feels the same, and she can't be here because she's in America, working in America. Just before we go to Robert Fox, who has to go back to Oxford, I'm doing this slightly with a degree of reservation, but there's another student of my mother, Simon Duke, who's professor at Maastricht, and he wrote a very important book about American deployments and basing rights in the United Kingdom, based on work that she had done on the recommendation of my mother. Now, this is about 4.5 minutes long, and I'm afraid one thing has confounded me. Turning a feed of an image like that on an iPhone into something which is that. So I'm afraid you're going to see Simon Duke on his side.
I'm sorry, I can't be Duke. Hello, Nick. Dear colleagues, dear friends.
Wait a minute. It's not that
I
bad normally. It's not that bad normally, but I think it's actually indicative of all that Jeff has explained, but important because of one particular story.
Dear colleagues, dear friends, I'm sorry I can't be with you today at this marvellous event.
I can't even turn the laptop either from the screen.
I would have enjoyed it very much. Since I can't be there, I thought I would share some brief reminiscences about my days at Oxford as a graduate student in the early to mid-1980s. I had just finished my MPhil, and I was casting around for a topic for my doctoral thesis. I thought of doing something on post-war US military basing in the United Kingdom with an emphasis on the diplomatic and legal aspects. It was suggested that I go and see Professor Gowing in the History Department, so I made an appointment, and during our first meeting she asked me if I had read the work of Andrew Pierre on the evolution of Britain's independent nuclear deterrent. I had. We began a long discussion about his work and, of course, her own work in this regard. And it was only towards the end of the meeting that I presented my rather half-baked ideas for my doctoral thesis. I was surprised when shortly thereafter I heard that she agreed to take me on as her supervisee. Over the next months, she helped me distill my ideas for the thesis, and over the next 2 and a bit years, she helped me commit these ideas to paper. Margaret could be quite firm and quite critical. She would also demand that every version that she read should be typescript. This, of course, wouldn't be a problem now, but we were on the cusp of the computer age at that time. I didn't have a computer, and my SSRC grant certainly didn't stretch as far as typists' fees. So I worked as a bicycle mechanic in one of Oxford's better-known shops, and with the proceeds from that job, I would go out to Kidlington with my handwritten manuscript and have it typed up. And this I would then present to Margaret. I always sat there in her study in the history department, hoping that she wouldn't notice the traces of oil under my fingernails. I realise in retrospect that she probably would have quite enjoyed this. She could also be extremely encouraging. There were times of self-doubt, of a lack of confidence, and she would always buoy me up, convince me that I could do this, and encourage me to think beyond the thesis. It was also during this time that I discovered Margaret. She would invite me to lunch at Lineker on several occasions. I always felt this college was very much her. It was warm, it was welcoming, and unpretentious. And during these lunches, Margaret would tell me with considerable pride about her family. She would also talk about her days as a civil servant, as a young academic, and eventually her move to Oxford. I was tremendously warmed by these discussions, and we even compared notes on things like our mutual back pain as well. I hadn't been expecting this kind of friendship between a graduate student and an Oxford professor. It was quite a surprise to me and something I cherish to this day. When it came time to finish the thesis, the day of my viva voce approached, I arrived at the history department slightly early. And not really knowing what to do with myself, I decided that I'd better go to the bathroom because I didn't know how long the fiver would last. As I was approaching the gents, Margaret came out of the ladies. And in typical fashion, she looked at me and said, "Oh, hello, Simon. I don't think you have much to worry about." I soon felt tremendously relieved in every sense of the word. I kept in touch with Margaret after I left Oxford, and indeed, I dedicated a book to her. I don't think I'll ever match the standards that she set, but she has been an exemplar for me during my academic career. And I'm tremendously indebted to her for that. And it's with considerable pride that I call myself her last DPhil student.
Thank you. And please don't tell him that we sort of watched him on the side. Robert, I know you've got to dash to a train. Is there anything you can add, particularly after what we heard from Jeff, yes, about the challenges of keeping the centre open at Oxford?
I think, Nick, the overwhelming impression I have, particularly after the day, is that this just wasn't the job for Margaret. I'm thinking there of her background at LSE, about which we heard earlier today, about the working class origins of Portobello Road, on which, incidentally, I think there was no mention, at least in the time I was here, of Christ's Hospital. But that's a pretty privileged upbringing, actually, which my wife went through, and I know, of course, it drew Margaret from a very different world. I realise that. I just wonder whether, Nick, you feel that the working class background not only weighed with her, but even weighed on her, and in some way coloured her perception of Oxford, that where there was, particularly of old Oxford, and I think that was the sort of Oxford that she wanted to distance herself from. I mean, she didn't like the flummery of the old colleges and that sort of thing, which is partly why Lineker College, a new college, graduates only with no formalities and so on, was such a refuge for her. There she also found an older generation of scientists, Stephen Moorbath and Blaschko and people of that sort, whose company she valued enormously. She was very, very much at home there. I think the other aspect of her tenure of the chair, which went through from 1973 to 1986, therefore a lengthy time, 13 years, I think another aspect of her tenure was not only the difficulty that Roy referred to of the appointment and the issues surrounding her appointment, but you have to remember that those issues lived with her right through her tenure, and that the person who was referred to as her, as some would have said, the obvious candidate for the chair, that person remained in post alongside her right through, or virtually right through, the whole of that period. And I think the relations there were extremely difficult. They made Margaret's life difficult, and I think they impeded the development of the subject. I went to the chair. Margaret retired in 86. I was appointed in 88. I had the advantage of having worked at the University of Lancaster for most of that time, in other words, never set foot in Oxford at all, and had therefore never been called upon to take sides in this running battle, which by all accounts existed, and you may have got echoes of that in Oxford. I had been supervised by Alistair Crombie, who embodied a very different approach to the history of science. It was very much history and philosophy of science. I remember Alistair insisting to me that the history of science was all about the history of scientific thought. It was the history of ideas. Well, you couldn't imagine, and that was enough, and you couldn't imagine any perception, I think, of the subject more removed from Margaret's. So I just feel that the burden she was asked to bear was considerable. I can see the job looked attractive, as it looked attractive to me. You look at the job spec, and it said professors will be expected to teach for 36 hours a year. Well, my children worked out that's 40 minutes a week, and you thought, even at your advanced age, you might be able to do it. But get there, and if you're going to make a go of the job at all, it means constant engagement, networking, currying favour with allies and so on and so forth. So I think it was a job that was very hard to reconcile with the sort of work she was still trying to carry on doing. So I had a very soft spot, Nick, as you know, I think. I had a very soft spot for Margaret. I think she was dealt a pretty rough hand, probably rougher than she could ever have imagined when she applied for the job.
Robert, thank you very much indeed. So it's not an easy time, even for us in the family. I mean, there's all this distinction here, and much of it is well documented here in the monograph, and it's not something we can sort of push to one side. And Robert, thank you for your frankness as well. But just before we break for tea, let me just introduce you to Jarl Lamaki, who's just come here from Iceland. But we've known each other for 50 years, and he knew Margaret, my mother, when we were growing up, and we were teenagers together. But he has some very sharp, as he often used to write to me, not in emails, but on postcards, he has very sharp observations of the kind of person and parent and person to be with that my mother was. 2 or 3 minutes, sharp.
My English is very poor, but you see me vertically, at least. I stayed with Margaret and Vera and Donald, James and Nick's father, in Chiswick first, and then she moved to Canterbury and stayed with her a couple of times. I met her in Paris also when her book was translated into French by Goldsmith. A shortened edition of the book. And her day started very early at 6 o'clock. She had to prepare her teaching. She had to, in Canterbury, she had to teach some subjects she was not prepared to. 6 o'clock in a hot bath, because she was always freezing. And then she went to work and came back very late. She was always exhausted, as she said. But we had a thimble of sherry. It's only recently that I understood what thimble means in English. But in my mind, it was a small glass of sherry. And then we had very long conversations, and what strikes me now is how this person who lived for her work, for her studies, talked extremely personally with me. I was a very young man of the 68 generation, and we talked about never about nuclear energy, but about politics. I was a French leftist, and she was English socialist, and not of the same generation. And she had extremely strong convictions around her. Her friends sent their children to public school. She decided to send them to a comprehensive school. She meant each word she said. But each word she said. But what strike me also, it was a kind of suffering in her life, because she never allowed herself to not to do all her duties. She was always working and preparing dinner, looking for the children, as if she was punishing herself for something. I don't know what it was. If there was a difference between us, it was not political, it was not. It was a question of generation. She was haunted by the poverty she had lived in her youth, while I belong to a generation which doesn't know what poverty means. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Well, Charles, thank you very much, and Maria as well, for coming on the Eurostar this morning, because you're in Paris as well. So thank you very much indeed. There's still outstanding business after tea, particularly about what can be learned from this for the future writing of histories, with this very distinguished panel at 4 o'clock. So please stick around, because we want to bring this together, not just looking back at Margaret Gowing, but also examining how things work today and the legacy that's been left, but also, as Peter mentioned right early on today, the challenge now for doing the same kind of thing. Can it be done? Will we know as much from these kind of programs in future? Because emails can be deleted very quickly within the registry. Let's have some tea.